Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I'm Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland, and I'm your hostess for this evening, and I welcome you to our show. As always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamily.com. A group of people who understand that each one of us is this nation. We believe in the ideals and the ethics of our founding fathers, that this experiment in freedom relies on each and every one of us to succeed. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, our topic is one size education. One size fits all education. In our current progressive world, the almighty progressive philosopher kings, through the offices of Common Core and the free appropriate public education doctrine of the Department of Education, and the progressive ideology that being career ready means ready to be plugged into the Borg collective, we are being told that our children all will fit into this lovely new world order because we'll have a spot picked out for them that we will choose based on standardized testing and RFID chips that monitor things like blood pressure and blood sugar and attention span so that your child becomes the perfect fit in the collective group. We can make one-size-fits-all education if we just technologize it enough and standardize it enough and allow benevolent government to make all of our decisions for us. Freedom, individuality, creativity, uniqueness don't figure into the mix. unless it is the uniqueness of your particular plug into which you insert your child once they are out of your care, so that he or she is a happy cog in the progressive machine. I've had several experiences this week at work with the one-size-fits-all educational theory. I had a student who has been in my ISS classroom consistently for the over a year that he's been at our middle school. And every time he's in there, I have to send him out because his behavior is totally inappropriate to the classroom. He gets sent back to me because he has a holy IEP, Individualized Educational Plan, which means that he can't help it. And even though his IEP does not indicate that he is excused from disciplinary measures when his behavior is inappropriate, somehow or other, he always is excused from disciplinary measures when his behavior is inappropriate because he has an IEP. I had the assistant principal at my school tell me that, well, he has an IEP, and I'm not using that as an excuse, but it kind of reminds me of, you, if you like your plan, you can keep it. I hear the same thing over and over and over again, ladies and gentlemen, not from teachers, but from administrators and from the special education department. Today, I was helping to oversee benchmark testing makeups for students who missed their benchmark test for the first 9 weeks of the school and had to take it in grade-level groups. Not all of the children were taking the same test. Some had one test to make up, some had two, some had three, some had all four of the core tests to make up. And one student came in, and he was not scheduled for a makeup test, because he needs his test read aloud. And when he came in, the woman in charge of our testing protocols asked him why he was there, and he said he was there to take his test. And she said, well, you know, if you want to, you can take it on the computer unassisted. And he said, okay. And then I got a call from his special education case working teacher that I was to go and ask him if he wanted to take it and raise his hand when he needed something read, or if he wanted to wait and do it when someone read the whole thing out loud to him. And he decided that, no, he wanted to wait. So we sent him back to class until someone could find a computer and a person to read the entire test out loud to him. And this is the benchmark of whether or not this child in seventh grade has learned what he needs to know about science in seventh grade. One size fits all. In other words, he's going to be held to the same standards as everybody else, except for the fact that he cannot read at grade level and understand well enough to be able to read and do his test on his own. Again, the holy IEP intervenes. The whole paradigm of the one-size-fits-all common core progressive mentality is skewed so far from reality that it belongs in an unknown galaxy beyond the rim of the one that we can see. One-size-fits-all education is just about as logical as one-size-fits-all unisex underwear for everyone from birth until death. It pre-assumes that if we just make the standards, obviously everyone will be taught to achieve proficiency in all of them, no matter what their difficulty, no matter what their learning problem, no matter what their mood at the moment, no matter what their ability to focus in a class, no matter what their distractibility quotient is, no matter what their IQ is, ladies and gentlemen. If we just make these standards rigorous enough, everybody will be career ready after 12 years in the public schools. The absurdity of it is obvious to anyone who has a functioning brain, which of course means that progressives just can't or won't see it. Progressive liberalism, ladies and gentlemen, is a mental disorder. It creates an alternate reality and presupposes that everyone is going to dive right in and take part, even though it's absurd, even though it's stupid, even though it's counterproductive, and certainly even though it doesn't work. Ideally, the best education is where a student gains knowledge by listening, by doing, by reasoning, and by reading. We are educable creatures. That is one of the reasons why we are still at the top of the food chain. We are adaptable. We are capable of using our mentation to solve problems, to look at them from many different perspectives, and to think outside of the box. It is why, as I said, we are still top of the food chain. We are not born to a certain spot in society. We are not psychologically, emotionally, and physically programmed to fit a certain niche in the Borg collective. We are individuals, unique and totally capable of achieving what we put our mind and our hopes on. One-size-fits-all education eliminates that uniqueness because it assumes that if we just have enough data, we can program predictably exactly what each child would, should, and could be by the time they reach adulthood under the auspices of our benevolent and loving government. When it's put that way, even the most willfully ignorant individual in the world can tell right off the bat that it's not going to work. But because we tend to want to stay inside a comfort zone, and we want to believe that our elected officials are doing the job we elected them to do, which is to promote the general welfare, and I don't mean the welfare system, and to provide for the common defense and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. But that's not what our so benevolent and so wise elected officials are doing. We need to wake up to the fact that they too are flawed human beings. And simply because they are elected to office does not mean they are automatically capable of deciding exactly what your child should grow up to be. If we do not stand up, ladies and gentlemen, and say there is no such thing as one size fits all anything, our children will be the victims of this progressive mentality. And we will have something that bears no resemblance to the nation that we love and that our founders fought and died to give us. There is no way, ladies and gentlemen, that we can educate every single child individually and uniquely according to his or her skills, talents, difficulties, and needs. Not in a public system that is paid for with taxpayer funds, and has to adhere to ridiculous dictates from Washington, D.C., and people who are not educators, but who publish testing materials and textbooks and have bought their way into political power. Our nation, ladies and gentlemen, was founded by men who understood what it means to be a human being. They were what I like to call practical idealists. They were idealists in that they believed that human beings could govern themselves as individuals and as communities and nations. But they were practical in that they understood that they would still be basically less than perfect. That is why they created our Constitution and why they left an important matter like the education of our children out of the hands of a central bureaucracy and in the hands of state governments, which were closer to the people whose children were being educated. The further you remove responsibility and power from those who have delegated it to you, the more likely that power is to be abused. We see it every day, ladies and gentlemen, in pronouncements from the White House and dial backs and flip-flops and words that sound wonderful and mean nothing and promises that are never kept. I, for one, do not wish to hand my grandchildren over to the Borg Collective with a smile and a gee thank you. I don't want to hand anybody else's grandchildren over to them either. Our public educational system is not intended to provide a standardized test as a means of measuring the abilities of our kids. That is what it is being described as now. It's the mechanistic progressive thinking pattern that has undermined this nation's educational system. Progressives view human beings as statistics, as members of specific focus groups or demographics. Their circumstances, their economic status, their race, their religious convictions, the size of their families, the physical attributes they have or do not have, all of these things are to be codified onto, if you will, a modern punch card that will be slotted into the progressive machine and spit out into exactly the correct niche in society. Without effort or desire or passion or joy in the process for those who are being so slotted. I don't know how many of you out there have gone through the public system in the last 25 to 30 years. Those of you who have been basically tested to death and dealt with as if you were to remain children your entire lives. Those of us who went through education, public education, prior to the 1980s, had a very different philosophy on which their education was based. Those of us who were fortunate enough to predate progressive control of our educational system were taught that school required active participation by both teachers and students, and that in order for the teachers to do their job, the students had to be receptive to learning what the teacher had to teach. An effort must be put forth on both parties' behalf in order for the goal of an educated citizen to emerge at the end of the system's projected 12 years of classroom study. It was not perfect, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of kids, quote-unquote, fell through the cracks because, for whatever reason, they could not fit into and understand well enough in the traditional classroom model. But it had one shining improvement on the current state of education. It taught us that learning requires work and time and attention. That it wasn't magic. That it wasn't a, I want to feel good about myself, so give me an A. It wasn't everybody gets a trophy, everybody gets to be valedictorian, or we can't have valedictorian because it'll make the students who didn't succeed academically as well feel bad. It will kill this nation, ladies and gentlemen, if we continue along the path we're currently following in our public schools. Instead of offering the opportunity that our founders envisioned, and they did, all of them desired to have education available to every child, no matter his or her economic background or state of living. It will eliminate that chance to learn for every kid in this nation. Because it won't be learning, it will be indoctrination and training. There is a certain degree of training involved in becoming educated, ladies and gentlemen. Training the mind, training the will, and training the behavior so that the actions of one student do not disrupt everyone else's opportunity to learn. But public education, in the minds of our founders, or education itself, was about learning to think, to evaluate, to draw conclusions based upon what you had read and learned, and to use what you had read and learned as a stepping stone to imagine greater. Our founders, most of them, were self-educated men. Those who came from wealthy families were given tutors and the opportunity to learn from a very young age. Those who did not come from wealth learned how to read, and from then they took off and flew. But our educational system is saying it's unimportant to be able to read. You don't need to be able to read to know things. You just need somebody following you around all the time and telling you everything you need to know. You need a personal minder to train you into a niche so that the government knows that you are being productive and feeding the progressive machine and not bothering anybody in the process. The one-size-all, one-size-fits-all approach that says that all we have to do is have enough standardized tests and enough data mining, and obviously we'll be able to make sure that everybody goes to college and everybody becomes CEO of a company. It's absurd on the face of it. And this constant passion for integration within the group is so utterly Fabian socialism that it's laughable. The understanding that groups form in order to accomplish common goals just seems to have passed 99% of progressives by. The idea that somehow or other making a group diverse, in other words, one of this, one of that, like a box of chocolates, to quote Forrest Gump, is that that box of chocolates never really achieves anything. My friend Linda just mentioned in the chat room that it's just like China and Russia, where they pluck the kids out and say, this is the path you're going down no matter what. And that's exactly correct. This is what Common Core and the rest of this garbage is leading to. The creation of the Borg Collective. And I know that there are folks out there listening to me who think, oh, this is a crazy old lady. She's got, you know, sci-fi on the brain. She's a conspiracy theorist. Fine. You think whatever you like. God bless you. That's still free. But even though I don't claim to be a visionary or a prophet or endowed by whatever superpower to see the future, I am a reasonably intelligent human being. And I've lived long enough and experienced enough in my life to understand that this kind of diversity is a myth. You don't create diversity, which is what progressives want to do as a goal. You create unity within diversity. That's what E pluribus unum means. Out of many, one. It doesn't mean many become one. It doesn't eliminate the many to make one. It is the understanding that our divergent, wildly different uniqueness is our greatest strength. And we will find our groups if you just let us the heck alone. Social engineering, ladies and gentlemen, is the most dangerous concept that this nation has ever been exposed to. It has been tried over and over again since the early part of the 20th century. And it's the same batch of fuzzy-minded idiots doing it again now in the 21st. The assumption that so long as I'm an elected bureaucrat, I am endowed by God with the same abilities as the Creator. I have power, therefore I am God, and I can redesign humanity to fit into my perceived utopia. Success to progressives is not individual achievement, ladies and gentlemen. Success to progressives is everybody in his place and nobody getting out of it because they are scared to death. They can't function alone. Our founding fathers lived at a time when 90% of this great nation of ours was unexplored territory. And people who need the group to bolster their self-esteem don't go out and explore anything new because they can't take the group with them. And they can't find familiarity. And they aren't going to be cushioned and coddled and have a nipple placed in their mouth along the whole journey so that they don't get scared being away from mommy. We are telling our kids that they can remain children until they die. My friend Linda also mentioned the founders treated young men of 12 and 13 as adults. They certainly did. And they aren't the only ones. Why do you think a bar mitzvah is held for a young man and a bat mitzvah for a young lady at the ages of 12 or between 12 and 15? And Linda mentions that George Washington was a paid surveyor at 14. Those of you who are products of the last 30 years of education, those of you who were born in the 1970s or the late 60s may very well remember your parents and what they did when they were 12, 13, and 14. Many of them were out mowing lawns to earn extra money over and above their allowance. Many of them had part-time jobs after school. Many of them worked side by side with their parents in family-owned businesses or on family farms. They didn't lose their childhood, ladies and gentlemen. They progressed through it and began to learn how to be adults by living in the real world, by understanding what it meant to do a job and be compensated for it based on whether or not you did the job correctly and well. They were introduced to the concept that what you want has to be earned. It isn't handed to you by a benevolent government on a happy little plate with a smiley face and a cell phone on the side. I was reading an article on The Blaze this afternoon when I came home from school regarding the elimination of the teaching of cursive writing in Common Core standards and the fact that five or six states, possibly more, are doing everything they can to get cursive back into the curriculum. And among these is California, which sounds really crazy when you stop to consider how crazy California is. Sorry, Linda, I don't think you're crazy just because you live there. But there have been several studies, according to this article, that indicate learning cursive is excellent training for the ability to be creative and to think logically and carefully before spilling out whatever happens to be on your mind. I learned cursive, or I began learning cursive when I was in third grade. I attended a private Catholic school first through third grade until I was a nervous wreck and my dear grandmother convinced my parents to put me in public school so I didn't have a nervous breakdown. But even the kids in public school had been introduced to cursive in third grade. And we had handwriting. And we could read cursive because our teachers wrote on the board using cursive. The number of college freshmen and sophomores who actually write in cursive and who can read other people's is probably somewhere around 20% right now. In other words, most of them would not be able to decipher the Declaration of Independence, the original document, at all. They would be unable to read the journals and letters of our founding fathers, or our great artists, or our great political leaders, or philosophers, or writers. Because being able to write well was the hallmark of an educated person when our forefathers created this nation. Learning cursive, practicing cursive, helps children master small motor skills. One of the reasons why little boys' handwriting in third grade is 99% indecipherable. I used to kid my husband, I was the only one who could read his handwriting, and he'd laugh and say nobody else could do it. And I said, well, love, after all, I can read third grade boys' handwriting. Yours is a snap. And he'd laugh. I could even read his father's handwriting, and nobody else in the family could. But that was because I was taught cursive, both how to read it and how to write it. I remember when I was in school, I don't know how many of you did it, practicing different ways to write your name. You know, backhand, rounded, spiked, all the different styles of handwriting until you found one that was comfortable for you. And it wasn't manuscript, it wasn't printing, it was cursive. And that was fun. My friend Movin says they don't teach cursive anymore, and you're quite correct, they don't. I work in a middle school, and when I write instructions on the whiteboard for my students, I have to write it in manuscript because 99% of them cannot read cursive handwriting. Very, very few of them can actually write their own names in cursive. The handwriting classes that I took when I was young, I don't know, there may be some old fogies like me out there listening in the audience. Remember the pothooks we used to do, the S shapes and the figure eights and the spike turns and the curves, the C's and long lines, to get our muscles used to creating it. My friend Bill says it's going to be easier to commit check fraud because it's much, much easier to manufacture the current type of quote-unquote signature, which is getting more and more electronic, and even the actual signatures of real people, because there is no cursive handwriting. Our current creature in the White House made a joke about the fact that the new Secretary of the Treasury's signature was indecipherable. You can't read it. The love of technology and the desire to make our kids ready for a world that operates 99% of the time on technological expertise is understandable. It's a wonderful thing. But as I have said over and over and over again, technology is a wonderful servant, but it is a poor master. I have taught handwriting, ladies and gentlemen, to my students when they were in ISS. I've taught handwriting when I was a private tutor. I can still teach handwriting because I learned how to do it. And the other thing that bringing cursive back or reinstating it or paying any attention to it at all will do for our kids is get them used to the idea that what they do is looked at. In a sense, learning to write cursive, okay, is one of the first steps to being able to draw, design, and create in the plastic arts. It is an art form. I loved my art classes in high school because every year we had at least one marking period where we did lettering. My father taught me how to use a crow quill when I was about 9. He was a draftsman when he got out of high school and loved to do calligraphy. He could and did use pen and ink to create the Gothic style lettering that you see in manuscripts from the 16th and 17th century. He was incredibly good at it. And my goal was to be as good as he was. I never quite made it, but I came close. But doing that gave me so much pride in myself. It was not easy to do. It took a lot of effort. It took a lot of practice. But I did it. And I get compliments on my handwriting today. Purely and simply because I was taught how to do it. And because I used that skill over and over and over again through my entire life. Understanding that anything that you do requires effort in order to get better came with learning to write in cursive. And understanding that about cursive carried over into every other subject we were taught. That if you wanted to be better at math, you had to work harder. If you wanted a better grade in science, you had to work harder. And some people did work harder and did improve. Others did not because they weren't willing to work. And so their grades reflected that. It was not, oh, gee, he tried hard, even though he spelled cat P-L-W. We'll give him an A for effort. No, we didn't get an A for effort. We got an A for a 93% or above mastery of whatever subject we were doing. There was another interesting little article on the Blaze that I saw today. I believe it was on the Blaze. Or it may have been a link on Facebook. I don't remember exactly, but there was a woman who was absolutely furious that her son made honor roll because his grade point average was 1/100th of a point on the right side of honor roll, even though he got a D and a C in core subjects on his report card. And she was outraged. My friend Linda saw it too, and it was on the Blaze. And justifiably so. Because that tells her son that adequate is the goal and not excellence. And how are we going to have a nation that excels if we tell our children that the goal is to be adequate and that you have to be identical to everyone else in your desires, your success, your potential, etc. Progressives prate a lot about diversity, ladies and gentlemen, but they don't actually believe that diversity is a good thing. They use the term to describe there is no right and wrong, everything is okay so long as it makes you feel good, which harks back to the tune in, turn on, and drop out of the 60s, you know, whatever blows your dress up, just go do it, which we're reaping the harvest of now. the absurdity of teaching children that mediocrity is a desirable goal should be obvious. But unfortunately, it's not. Because we have two generations now of people who are going to be, or are, parents who grew up believing that mediocrity was the goal that they should achieve. That excellence or brilliance or unique creativity was to be avoided at all costs because you won't fit in. Other people will be mad at you and feel bad if you're smarter than they are. You won't have any friends unless you dumb down so you don't hurt people's feelings. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I guess I'm an evil, nasty old witch. Well, I know I'm an evil, nasty old witch. That's why they have me in school suspension. But anyway, as an evil, nasty old witch, I do not talk down to my students. I speak to them as I would to anyone. And I tell them at the start that if I use a word they don't understand or if I explain something and it isn't clear, all they have to do is tell me and I will explain it a different way. Or I will tell them what the word means or show it to them in the dictionary. My job is not to make them feel good, ladies and gentlemen. My job is to educate them. And we are not educated when we never hear a word we've never heard before. We remain at age 4 1/2 until we die. The more we dumb our children down with one-size-fits-all education and data mining and data-driven this and data that and data whatever the hell else we do, the less likely we are to preserve our freedoms. Our kids have to understand that some things require effort and they are worth the effort they require. Our kids need to understand that mediocrity is not a goal, but that excellence is, in whatever way you can excel. There is something in each of us that we can be proud of and feel good about, ladies and gentlemen, simply because we are human beings, a little lower than the angels and a little higher than the beasts. Each of us has a piece of our Creator within us. Each of us has a light that can shine on something. One-size-fits-all education does not accept this. One-size-fits-all education says that everyone's light must be identical to everyone else's. That we all must be candles. And only the progressive elite can be a larger candle than you are. No one's allowed to be an electric light bulb, because that would be putting forth more light and all the candles would feel badly because they were being outshone. This is not the nation I was born in, ladies and gentlemen. It's not the nation I wish my grandchildren to live in. If we continue telling our kids that there is no reason to strive, and that success means having stuff like everybody else's stuff, and that there is no bad behavior, only communication we don't understand. That doesn't create a nation of people who build and create and explore. and make the world better because they are not satisfied with stuff and mediocrity. This nation grew because of immigration in the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, ladies and gentlemen. And it wasn't the integration of those who were trying to have anchor babies and get on the welfare rolls. It was the immigration of people who were not satisfied where they came from and wanted to go somewhere where they had more opportunity to succeed on their own merits. It grew because people believed that it was the land of opportunity, not the land of everybody gets a check and everybody has equal stuff in everybody's house. It was a chance and hope, real hope, not just a one-word political slogan, but the real hope that lives in every human being that tomorrow can be better than today. And it was the hope that you'd have a chance to prove your worth without artificial barriers of class or lineage stopping you from doing so. You don't settle a nation as large as this one, explore it from coast to coast, if all you are concerned about is fitting into the group. If the group is your ideal, you will never leave where you started from because you will be tied to and enslaved by group security. My friend Bill said they should have worked together to go back and straighten out their own countries instead of trying to turn us into the hole they ran from to begin with. And he's quite correct there. Because our current, quote-unquote, immigration, undocumented aliens, which I think is the politically correct buzzword of the week, many of those people are coming here for the same reasons that the immigrants of the late 1800s and early 1900s came. The chance to make a better life. Many of them still do come for that reason. But they get seduced by the power brokers and the political hacks and the vultures who use them for the food to get the power they crave. The Al Sharptons of this world. The Jesse Jacksons of this world. The Barack Obamas of this world. They are not individuals to these people, ladies and gentlemen. They're voting blocks. They're people who can be bought to get on a bus and driven to a polling place and then driven to another one to vote again. Because when you're hungry or your kids are hungry or you want something that you've never even had and you see other people have, it's very easy for someone to buy you. We can all be bought, ladies and gentlemen. The price is just a little different for each one of us. Progressives understand this, and they use it. And they have been using it for 30 years on our children. They are buying your children with feel-good promises. They are buying this nation with one size fits all and that everybody should have equal stuff with everybody else in his house. And I'm sure they'd try to buy you with everybody should have equal stuff with everybody else in his heart and mind and spirit too, but even they can't quite manage to sell that one. Because unless you live in a cave on a mountainside and never see anyone, you can figure out that not everybody has equal stuff in their minds and hearts and spirits. It is this machine mentality that creates the one-size-fits-all of our current educational system, ladies and gentlemen. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a Luddite or a saboteur, which, of course, the saboteur comes from the French word for shoe, meaning throwing a shoe into the works of the factory because you don't have a job on the land anymore because they pay women and children pennies to do what a full-grown man couldn't feed his family on. I don't want to return us to a pastoral, happy agrarian economy where all the happy peasants are singing in the fields. No, I'm sorry. Not interested. I don't want to labor from dawn to dusk and go home to my well-earned rest to pound my laundry on a rock. I like technology. I like machines that do work for me. I like the leisure time they give me. But liking something and being addicted to it are not the same thing. Technology, like any other good, can be addictive. It has proven to be addictive to the progressives who currently retain political power in the Senate and the White House. They know how to use it and how to manipulate it, and how to convince people that they too are cogs in the great progressive machine, and we will all like ourselves much better if we just fit into the right slot and are assured of comfort and ease and perfect safety and a risk-free life. All we have to do is hand over to them our freedom to choose, and we will be safe and comfortable until they decide we've lived long enough and they kill us. And that's pretty much it. That's built into Obamacare, in case you hadn't noticed. My friend Linda puts it quite clearly. All that is needed is to sell your soul. Because souls are uncomfortable things. Souls make us learn about things like conscience and right and wrong and compassion and caring and love and sorrow and grief and pain and failure. And we don't want those nasty, uncomfortable things. Heavens, no, we want our trophy and we want to feel good about ourselves. Don't tell me I'll be sad. You make me feel bad. Don't tell me I'll fail. You hurt my feelings. Don't tell me you don't like beets because I think beets are wonderful and you're just telling me I'm stupid because I like them. I'm not kidding you, ladies and gentlemen. This is exactly what I hear from our children, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. What in the name of heaven are these kids going to do when they are out there in the real world and somebody is expecting them to perform in order to earn their salary? What are they going to do? They're probably going to have to move to China or Korea or Taiwan or India or somewhere to get a job in a call center. Or putting part A and part B all every day for 10 hours and then going home to the dormitory where they're fed and they have a blanket and they have a rec room and a restaurant that is a company store. My friend Morb says they're all going to become police officers. Yeah, kind of. In the sense that it used to be, okay, it used to be that we were taught, I remember long, long ago when I was in grade school, officers would come to the school and tell us about safety and things like that. And our parents told us if you get lost or if you're scared, if you see a policeman, you go right up because he'll help you. And then the 60s hit. And my generation immediately was told, all cops are fascist pigs and all they want to do is shoot you. They're hateful, they're rotten, etc. Well, neither view was completely correct because police officers, like everybody else, come all sorts. Anyone who follows a career that gives them authority over others is in danger of abuse of power. That includes police officers, judges, teachers, lawyers, doctors. Any profession where you are an authority, where you have the power. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. It is a cliche and an old saw because it is true, ladies and gentlemen. Progressives understand this, but they shove under the rug the absolute power corrupting absolutely part. And they see themselves as being incorruptible because they know so well what is the right thing for us. They are the enlightened. They are the philosopher kings. They understand that our best goal is to become a complacent, contented cog in the progressive machine. And once they have us convinced that this is our way to safety, security, comfort, and a risk-free life, then the world will be utopia, and they will be in charge forever. And they can indulge their love of power and assume the mantle of godhood, which they so firmly believe they deserve. Because no one will question their right to wear that mantle, because no one will be allowed to think. Thinking is dangerous. I don't know how many of you were forced to read Shakespeare in high school. I was. Didn't take much force. You know, first two sentences and I was hooked for life. But those of you who did might remember Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar. And Caesar is talking to one of the those attending him after he has reluctantly accepted the crown. And he says to his interlocutor, "Yon Cassius has a lean and hungry look. Such men are dangerous. Such men think too much." I'm paraphrasing. But Caesar understood that the danger to those who hold power is the man or woman who thinks. And making our children into non-thinkers is the goal of one-size-fits-all education. Teach them to the test. Spend all of your time getting them ready to score well on a standardized test and directly and indirectly tell them that this is the mark of success for their future. And that if they do not score well, they will be scorned or eliminated from participation in life at its best level because they didn't learn what the test says they're supposed to learn. The purpose of standardized tests, as they were originally intended, ladies and gentlemen, and we had them when I was in school. I remember we did the ITBS, the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, from basically third grade all the way up through parts of high school, actually through about eighth grade. And then we had PSATs and SATs in high school. But what they were intended to do was to measure the level of mastery we had achieved in the core subject areas so that the teachers and our parents could determine whether or not we were ready to go on to the next level of learning. They were standardized so that a child who, say, went to first through third grade in Connecticut and then moved to Texas, okay, and attended fourth through eighth there, would have some kind of measurement of where he or she was in preparation for advancement to the next grade level. That's what they were for. They were a measure of a child's mastery of the material he or she had been taught so that they were prepared to learn new material that was built on those skills in the next academic year. That was supposedly the purpose of the Standards of Learning Test, the SOLs as we have them here in Virginia, and every other state's standardized testing, to determine whether or not the student was ready to pass on to the next grade level, had understood the basic concepts of, say, sixth grade, so that they were ready to engage in seventh grade work. A perfect example, math is the easiest one to measure because it doesn't have as many, esoteric elements to it. If you had not mastered the four operations with fractions, for example, in fifth grade, you were going to have a great deal of trouble understanding decimals and percentages in sixth grade and making the comparison among the three different types of numbers that were less than one. In science, your understanding of basic scientific method, the vocabulary of science, was necessary for you to progress from, say, earth science, the understanding of weather patterns and winds and so on and so forth, into biology, because that discipline was about the various living creatures with whom you shared the planet, and it brought into its study things that you learned about in the way that climate affects evolution of species, and they develop different communities and different body parts to adapt to different types of earthly conditions and so on. So education was seen as a stair step. Each step gave you a platform of learning from which you could then progress to the next step and master that platform and so on up the ladder. You were introduced to more and more vocabulary in English as you got older. You started with see Dick and Jane, see Spot, run, Spot likes Jane, Jane likes Spot, to, you know, the Johnny Tremaine in 8th grade by Esther Forbes, and then Shakespeare in 10th, 11th, and 12th. And it was a logical progression. The understanding that in order to advance academically and in knowledge, you needed to master certain skills. If you could not read, you were not going to be able to do word problems in mathematics or understand explanations in science or the founding documents in American history or the differences and similarities between civilizations in world history or the functions of the different branches of government in civics. Your first 3 years or so in school were spent mastering number concepts, sequence, quantity, the four operations with whole numbers, adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing, number relationships, greater than and less than, learning to read, to decode letters, to sound out words, to understand the dictionary and what information it gave you, to be able to read something and comprehend it well enough to make a statement about what was said, to be able to draw conclusions from what you read. All of these things were necessary skills in order to progress to more advanced work. Passing was not a social necessity. It was an academic necessity if you were to do the next year's work. Well, passing is no longer the academic necessity, ladies and gentlemen. Passing to the next grade level is now 60% social success and 40% academic. As an example, the young student that I had today doing a benchmark test that he couldn't do because he has to have it read out loud to him in seventh grade. And I will tell you, because I know people are asking out there, how in the name of all that's holy did he manage to get to seventh grade? That happened because he's tall, ladies and gentlemen. And because his self-esteem would be damaged and his social life would be crippled if he didn't advance along with his peers. Four, obviously, if one's feelings are hurt, this is the most horrible crime that anyone can perpetrate against you. That's going to go on the hate crime list next. You wait and see. I'm offended. You've committed a hate crime. You offended me. You have perpetrated a hate crime on me. The assumption is, in the progressive mind, that the world of school is the only world, and that the children in it are going to determine who they are based on who they are in school, or who they are perceived to be. It's good old progressives again, taking a genuinely true aspect of growing up and inflating it to ridiculous purposes in order to achieve their ends. Yes, who you are in school does have an effect on who you become in later life. But the way progressives define it, who you are in school dooms you to be whatever they think you're going to be based on the data they have mined while you're there. Again, progressive mechanistic thinking. I'm sure that had progressive data mining and planning and so on and so forth and tracking, which is also really funny when you start to think that the progressives were always screaming about how bad it was to track people, and that's why we can't have special education classes. We have to have collaborative classes, because otherwise the poor kids who don't do as well will be tracked into dead-end jobs. Well, doggone it. You don't get tracked into the inability to think. You either have the ability to think or you don't. And I don't care how many standardized tests you give kids. If their intellectual ability is below normal, it's going to stay that way. Standardized testing and rigorous Common Core standards are not going to put brains in the heads of children who don't have them. But this is what progressives are telling you they will do. With all of this nonsense about everybody's going to be career ready. Everything is about fitting into the machine in your proper spot. Progressives talk a great deal about touchy-feely subjects like compassion and kindness and caring and welcoming diversity with open arms, and we're all brothers under the skin. They don't mean a word of it, ladies and gentlemen. They are just really, really good at sounding as if they do. Machines do not experience these things. And what they want from your children is to be a happy, contented cog in a machine, not a feeling, thinking, caring, individual human being. My friend Linda reminds us that that's why Common Core is part of the New World Order. Nothing of the individual and no mention of self-evident truths, because obviously we are incapable of recognizing a self-evident truth, because we have to be guided by those who are wiser and more enlightened than we are. Our children are fodder, ladies and gentlemen. It isn't, as Linda says, that we were created for equal outcomes. It is that we were created equal in opportunity. Progressives have always had a great deal of difficulty understanding the difference between alike and equal. To progressives, those two are perfect synonyms. To anyone who thinks, they are not. I am the equal of any other human being on this planet. But I am not alike to any other human being on this planet, and I never will be. I will have an equal opportunity under our original intent, as expressed in the Constitution, to find my niche in life based on my character, my abilities, my skills, my difficulties, my work ethic, my desire, my hopes, and my dreams. But my outcome is going to be just that, mine. Good, bad, or indifferent, it will be mine. And I will not spend my last days whining about how I didn't have a chance because I did. And whatever regrets I have will not be based upon somebody didn't give me something. They'll be based on I missed the chance to achieve because I neglected the opportunity to try. And I would be quite happy if that were my epitaph, ladies and gentlemen. Because it would be an honest epitaph. It would be true in the best sense of what I believe it means to be a human being. My success as a human being isn't based on how much money I have or how many things I can count in my house or what kind of car I drive or what job I do or who I'm associated with as in a marriage or a friendship or a work group or anything like that. My success is based on, did I live up to my potential? Did I give every opportunity in my path my best effort? And my regrets will be based only on my own failings, not on somebody didn't give me something. Who I am is nobody's fault but mine, and nobody's pride but mine. And I would like my grandchildren and yours to be able to say that same thing when they approach the end of their lives. I would like them to be able to look into the face of the divine and say, I know I didn't always do my best, and I'm sorry for that. But I did my best more often than I didn't. If I can say that, honestly and sincerely, I will take whatever consequences come to me in this life or whatever comes after it. Because I truly believe that my soul, my individuality, the spark of me that will be in existence when the physical being that encases it is no longer here, has to stand on its own, just as I have done, and and has to account for how many times I've reached out to help others and how many times I've been grateful for the hand reached out to me. My success is not based on somebody else's failure, ladies and gentlemen, or lack thereof. My success as a person is based on my efforts. Sometimes circumstances just don't give you an opportunity. Sometimes they do. That doesn't make the circumstances that didn't give you one the fault of some individual who's out to get you. It just is what it is. Our kids have to learn that there are no guarantees that follow you out of the womb. There is only the effort to try to make tomorrow better than it was today for yourself and for those you care about. And one-size-fits-all education and data mining and Common Core and the progressive machine will not give our children that candle flame to light their way through dark days. And they will meet dark days. We all do. Sometimes there isn't anybody to blow on that flame and make it stronger, or to add more fuel to our fire. Sometimes we have to nurse that flame all by ourselves and bring it back to life to light our way out of dark times. But our children are being told that they don't have to do that, that somebody else is going to come along and relight it for them, and all they have to do is just sit there. And those other people are going to come and light the fire for them again. There may be someone who will help you relight your fire. But I doubt that there'll be someone who will relight it every time it flickers. And I very much doubt that there'll be someone who relight it every single time you don't bother to keep it burning. I truly do believe, ladies and gentlemen, that as the intro to my show says with I Am the Nation, Johnny Cash is speaking for the United States, but he's also speaking as one individual person. Because every single thing he mentions, every single one of the people he cites, was just that, one of the people. It is we who are the nation, ladies and gentlemen. It is our voices that our elected officials are supposed to be using. And when we send someone to our local city council or our board of supervisors or our state legislature or the Senate or the House of Representatives of the United States, we'd better make damned sure that what they are speaking is what we believe. And we need to make sure that we stand up and speak out when we see that the direction in which these people are taking us is the wrong direction. And we need to think before we speak or do. I tell my students that there are two basic reasons why they wind up in ISS. Number one is the assumption that rules don't apply to me. And number two is failure to engage brain before engaging mouth or fists. And that is something that our kids need to learn by the example we set, ladies and gentlemen. Because counter to progressive thinking, we as parents and aunts and uncles and sisters and brothers and grandparents and cousins and neighbors need to present by example the kind of human beings who can govern themselves as individuals, if our children are going to grow up and take part in governing themselves as a nation. We have to embody what Dr. King said in his I Have a Dream speech, that a man be judged by the content of his character and not by the color of his skin. And we have to embody that in an even broader sense, that a person will be judged by the content of character rather than any other aspect of his personhood. What we look like, where we came from, what church we go to, what clothes we wear, what food we like to eat, what political party we belong to, all of these things are meaningless if the character of a good and decent person is not present. Because no matter how much progressives would like you to think so, you are not a group. You are an individual who makes the choice to put your individuality with that of others in a gathering of people who have a common goal. We have been seduced into believing groupthink, ladies and gentlemen. All you have to do is talk to any liberal and ask them what they think a typical member of the Tea Party is. They believe in the propagandized vilification of members of the Tea Party movement because they have been taught from childhood to think that group defines who you are. It's the perversion of perfectly true statements like birds of a feather flock together or you are known by the company you keep. Both of those things are true. But the progressive take on it is that everything you are is owed to whatever group with which you are affiliated. That any group you belong to defines you 100%. You are a series of data points. And that is why Common Core wants to know what church you take your children to, what doctor they see, what part of town you live in, so they can define your child, not based on who he or she is as an individual, but as a collection of group affiliations that they can steer into the correct group position in the Borg collective. And it is this underlying philosophy, ladies and gentlemen, at the heart of Common Core, and all of the auxiliary measures that go along with it, that we need to stand up against. It isn't about standards. It isn't about rigor. It isn't about academic success or competing on the world stage. You're being told it is.
90 seconds.
But that's a lie. And don't believe it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us tonight. And I will be here next Thursday, but the following Thursday, Thanksgiving, there will not be a Patriot Education, but I'll be back on the Thursday after that. Meanwhile, I wish you all the best of all worlds, and I believe in you and your willingness to stand up for what is true and right about this great country of ours. As always, all my love to my greatest fan. I'll see you all soon. Take care of yourselves, folks, and take care of each other. We are family. Good night, everybody.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.